our kingdom of England, and this pair, accustomed it, ought to be burnt with fire.
And James goes on with something very interesting. We, therefore, as a zealot of justice, I like the way he thinks of zealot as a good thing to be, as a zealot of justice and a defender of the Catholic faith. Now, what does he mean by that, Dermot? Because we've been talking about Catholics and Protestants, and here is James, the Protestant monarch, calling himself the defender of the Catholic faith.
Oh, that's perfectly simple. The whole point of the Reformation was that Protestants were restoring the true Catholic faith, the true Catholic faith of the first five centuries of the Church. And the whole point of the Reformation is that Roman Catholics are not true Catholics. And so a Protestant monarch is the defender of Catholic faith, on the one side against papists, Roman Catholics, and on the other against any old heretic. So that's exactly what any of the mainstream leaders of the Protestant Reformation would have said about themselves.
Whiteman is asked what he means in some of these papers that he's been reading out to strangers. He writes, for example, "I come as him that hath trodden the winepress alone," says the report of his examination. "He applieth them to himself, though that is a prophecy only proper and personal to Christ. He saith that the selfsame prophecy concerneth him as much as it does Christ." And this is the sort of thing which is unforgivable.
Yes, I mean, he's bigging himself up, and he's also depressing the status of Christ, who he sees as the perfect man. And that is way below the significance of Christ in the Trinity, as it had been accepted by the Church. And he also said that all the creeds of the Church were useless, and that's because they're so late. They're all constructed in the 4th and 5th centuries. So he's making a perfectly valid historical point there.
Yes, but one which is completely incompatible with the understandings of all kinds of mainstream Christianity.
Yeah. Yes. Protestants accepted those creeds just as much as Roman Catholics or Orthodox. That's the common ground of anyone who would want to be considered a mainstream Christian in the 16th or 17th century. And he'd stepped outside that common ground.
So in one sense, this is an argument about when the early church went wrong. Was it in the 8th century, as Protestants maintained, or in the 3rd century, as Whiteman?
Exactly. Which is the fork in the road? Is it back in the time of the Emperor Constantine, the 4th century, or is it much later when the Bishop of Rome got out of hand? And so that's the big difference between Whiteman and Bishop Neal of Lichfield. They're putting the going off the road in different centuries.
One of the things that struck me thinking about this appalling ceremony, we've been talking of it theologically, but it seems to me to go back to a rather pre-Christian tradition of human sacrifice, in a sense. One sees these stakes all across Europe as the boundary posts of a new orthodoxy.
There's a lot in that, I think. And the problem is that Protestants want to prove that they are more orthodox Christians than Roman Catholics. And they've got a real frisson about this because Catholics have said, "You're heretics. You are betraying the true church." And there is this famous Catholic jibe, "Where was your church before Luther?" And I think that rather haunted Protestants. Where was our church before Luther? And that means that they've got to be as true to the early church as they can be. And you get someone like Whiteman coming along and saying, actually, the early church was wrong. That's the secret. Protestants want to stand on the same foundations as Roman Catholics.
One of the points lurking in what you've been saying is that we think of this now as an expression of the rigidity of religion and of its intolerance of dissent. But actually, at the time, and in terms of the dynamics of the way the people doing it thought, what was the danger was the fluidity, the power, the fact that you couldn't actually specify without a human and political effort what it was that the early church was about.
Yes, I think they're grappling with the great flow of information which they had gained over the last century, the previous century, about the early church. And a lot of it was frankly disconcerting. They didn't know what to do with it. And in the end, of course, it would actually change the boundaries of Protestantism. It would create the modern liberal Protestantism, which we know. And they're just embarking on that long road at the time. And Whiteman, who, you know, is a fairly ludicrous as well as tragic figure, in some ways is the beginning of this process. He's one of the symptoms of looking at the early church and saying, well, it isn't like even Protestant history books say it is.
But it would be a brave, a foolhardy man who doubted the history books after he read of Whiteman's fate. When the fires were set around him, he cried out that he would recant. The crowd ran forward to put out the flames, and he survived, although he was well scorched. He was unchained, but taken back to jail. 2 weeks later, he appeared in court to make a full and proper recantation. He would not. One newsletter said he blasphemed more audaciously than before. And when the king heard, he ordered him burnt again. On the 11th of April, Edward Whiteman was brought once more to the stake. Once more, when he felt the flames, he screamed that he would recant, that he had never meant it. This time there was no mercy. The sheriff told him he should cozen him no more and commanded faggots to be set to him, where roaring he was burnt to ashes. The bishop, writing 30 years later, could only recall that Whiteman had died blaspheming.
If I were being an Oxford examiner on this, I would say that Edward Whiteman was a borderline case. And he's the borderline between being a heretic and being a loony. And the trouble was that in this case, his examiners put him on the heretic side rather than on the loony side. And this, I think, may be why he is the last one, that it's such a stretched case, it's such an untidy case, that a lot of influential people quietly thought to themselves, I don't think we want to see that again. They didn't say so, because it wasn't respectable to say so, but that the sort of wind had gone out of the sails of the persecuting impulse with Whiteman's burning.
But there was one more, deeper reason for this change. We glimpse it in the reaction of the crowd when Whiteman first recanted. They rushed forward then to save him, and they put the fire out even though some were burnt themselves. Common humanity, or Christian love, was for a moment stronger than the flames of orthodoxy, and would grow stronger still. Burning for heresy was finally abolished in England in 1677.
The Last Heretic was presented by Andrew Brown and produced by Louise Yeoman in Edinburgh. Readings were by Simon Tate, and Whiteman's prophecies were used by the permission of the Archives of Lincoln Cathedral. Welcome back to tonight's prom, given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Oliver Nusson. And the final work tonight commemorates another man who suffered for his faith, The Martyrdom of St. Sebastian, a piece by Debussy that was deemed so shocking the Pope threatened any Catholic who saw it with excommunication. This will be its first prom's outing, and as the stage is still being reset after the interval, it gives us the chance to find out more about the central character. St. Sebastian has been an icon of religious art since the mid-15th century. I went to the National Gallery in the company of curator Caroline Campbell to seek out one of the most famous depictions of the saint. Well, we're here in the Sainsbury Wing, and we're surrounded by lots of magnificent gilt frames with all sorts of paintings of saints and Madonnas. And then right at the end of the gallery is this huge altarpiece.
Yes, this enormous altarpiece of St. Sebastian. This painting was intended for an oratory in one of the key churches in Florence, this Annunciata, where there was an image of the miracle-working Virgin kept that was supposed to have been painted in the 13th century by divine intervention.
So I'd like to ask you, first of all, who was St. Sebastian? He's not someone we're terribly familiar with.
Well, he was a 3rd century Christian martyr. He was possibly born in Narbonne, possibly in Milan. The sources are not quite clear about this fact. But he was definitely the chief guard of the Emperor Diocletian, who was one of the persecutors of the early Christians before Constantine came on the scene. And Sebastian is somebody who converted to Christianity. Diocletian says that he wants Sebastian to be shot like a porcupine with arrows coming out of him like the spikes. But that doesn't kill him. He's rescued by a lovely woman, St. Irene, and he's nursed back to health. And then he is killed properly. He's dispatched with a sword. He doesn't really become a saint of incredible popularity, really, until about the 14th and the 15th centuries.
And why do you think Sebastian was such a popular figure for artists?
I think for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is that he was somebody who people wanted to have painted in altarpieces, which of course were religious devotional works. And there was a great plague, the Black Death, in the 14th century in Europe, and people became increasingly devoted to saints who were thought to save you from the pestilence. And Sebastian was one of these, because his body had been unblemished by the sort of arrows who were thrown at him, and he had survived that, though not subsequent punishments. So he often is associated with the plague and is thought to be a plague saint.
Who's it by, and why did they choose this subject?
Well, this painting is by a pair of brothers, Antonio and Piero del Pollaiolo, and they were two of the greatest Florentine artists of the mid-late 15th century. They weren't just painters, they were also active very much as sculptors. And I think you can see this in the painting, because we see St. Sebastian hoisted up on a tree trunk, made to look very much as if he's like Christ. And he's surrounded by all these archers, and their bodies are displayed consciously, so that we can see the human body in a 360-degree fashion, really.
And they're very different, aren't they? Because they're dressed in tunics which are belted, hoiked up, so that we can see their legs and their musculature of their arms and legs. But Sebastian in the middle is almost completely naked, apart from this little tiny loincloth, and then the arrows are hanging out of him in a rather unpleasant way.
He is, but he doesn't look terribly distressed by the fashion, which is also something I find very strange about this painting. And an early 16th century source by Giorgio Vasari, the first art historian, who of course was a great historian of Florentine painting, says that the figure of St. Sebastian was based on somebody who was the most beautiful boy of his generation, Ludovico Capponi.
And do you think it was just an excuse, because of the way that he was killed, to have this almost naked male figure in the centre of your supposedly devotional painting?
Well, that's a very interesting point. And historians have recently been working on the question of sort of same-sex relationships in 15th century Florence. And it was a city at the time that was notorious for its sodomy, or for the number of people who were engaged in same-sex relationships, or at least it was thought to be more accepted there than it was in other places. And this may have been some significance to the fact that we see this naked man in this Florentine altarpiece. And I think this is particularly apposite for Pollaiolo's painting from mid-15th century Florence. Sebastian begins to be confused with the iconography of Apollo, or of sort of earlier classical ideals of great male beauty. And I think in Florence, where they were really beginning to explore the relationship between the ancient Roman past and their civilization in a new way, and called themselves often the New Rome, this was particularly significant.
And he's being pierced by arrows shot by these archers at very close range. And they're using very different bows, aren't they? They're not all using the same type of bow.
No, some of them are using crossbows, which would have been really the height of military sophistication at this time. And others are using much more ornamental type bows, possibly meant to evoke more of a sort of Roman bow, because this is a scene that is set in ancient Christian Rome. And the Pollaiolo brothers are consciously trying to show this in their painting. There's a collapsed archway at the top left-hand side. So again, like images of early Christ, it's meant to evoke the superiority of Christianity to pagan civilization.
I was talking to Caroline Campbell from the National Gallery. Well, the first Proms performance of Debussy's The Martyrdom of St. Sebastian follows a brand new work, a BBC commission by the young composer Helen Grime. It's called Night Songs, and I asked Helen where the title came from.
Well, the title actually came from an artwork by Joseph Cornell. He was an American artist. He died in the 70s, I think. And he specialised in something called assemblage. So he made these boxes, and they're quite small, and they're usually themed, so some of them themed around birds and some of them are themed around night, and this one, night songs. It just immediately captured my imagination, and it's very much a sort of self-contained miniature world. And it sort of sparked off an idea for me. You know, I knew that I was writing a 5-minute piece and I wanted to encapsulate a specific sort of atmosphere, miniature world.
And how would you characterise night sound?
Well, there are sort of dreamlike, trance-like passages within the piece, but as the piece gets further through, these dreamlike episodes become more frantic, and there's a lot of underlying tension and sort of sometimes quite sinister sounds coming out from within the orchestra.
Helen Grime, who studied just across the road here at the Royal College of Music. Oliver Nussen has conducted her work at the Proms before. In 2009, the BBC Symphony Orchestra performed her piece called Virga, and Boulez went on to conduct its French premiere with the Orchestre de Paris the following year. Like Nussen, she's a composer who prefers not to rush. 2 or 3 pieces a year, Helen says, is as much as I can manage. Well, she has plenty of commissions pending from the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Centre and the Halle, where she's recently been appointed associate composer. And she has a wonderful down-to-earth attitude. One reason she gave up playing the oboe, she said, was all that fiddling with reeds. It brings on neurosis. Well, having said that, she's written an oboe concerto, and there's also a prominent role for oboes in the piece that we're about to hear. And the man to conduct that piece is Oliver Nussen. Coming on to conduct this birthday tribute to him, composed by Helen Grime. It's called Night Songs.
Thank you. fell off. I think we did all right, but I'd just like to play it again to make sure.
The joys of being 60.
The BBC Symphony Orchestra with that double world premiere, or perhaps a world premiere with the fastest instant repeat known in history of that BBC commission, Night Songs by Helen Grime. The piece, a tribute to the man conducting it tonight, Oliver Nusson, a keen champion of her music, so keen he wanted to play it all over again. Oliver Nusson greeting Helen Grime with a kiss on each cheek and enthusiastically joining in the applause. Well, Helen misses out on an anniversary by just a year. She was born in 1981, so she turned 30 last year. She studied oboe with John Anderson and composition with Julian Anderson and Edwin Roxburgh at the Royal College of Music. And she was there earlier on this evening talking to Helen's service, to Tom's service in one of our Proms composer portraits. That will be broadcast tonight at 10 o'clock, and it's available via Listen Again for the next 7 days. Just follow the links from the Radio 3 homepage at bbc.co.uk/Radio 3. Well, Oliver Nusson says he's crazy about art. Goya in particular, he's been getting into recently, appreciating him in the same sort of way that he appreciates Beethoven. Earlier, we heard about the attraction for painters of the figure of St. Sebastian, the 3rd century soldier who was persecuted for his Christian faith and shot with arrows on the orders of the Emperor Diocletian. It wasn't a painting, but a dancer who inspired the Italian writer Gabriele D'Annunzio to put together a multimedia extravaganza based on the martyrdom of St. Sebastian, inspired by medieval mystery plays. In 1910, keen to escape his creditors in Italy, D'Annunzio fled to Paris and was entranced by Ida Rubinstein's performances with the Ballet Russe. "Here," he said, "are the legs of St. Sebastian for which I've been searching for years." Ida Rubinstein not only had the legs and the androgynous beauty needed for the part, she also had the money to commission works for herself. And although various composers turned down D'Annunzio's offer to compose music for the piece, it was finally accepted by a penny-pinched Debussy. It was planned to unfold on a grand scale, incorporating 3 dances for Ida Rubinstein, 4 symphonic movements, choruses, and parts for a smaller number of voices. Debussy wrote just over an hour's music in all. Fokine was engaged as choreographer and Leon Bakst as designer. It can't be said it was a triumph. The whole production ran for over 5 hours in all, and audiences were bewildered by the mismatch between D'Annunzio's exuberant poetry and Debussy's subtly shifting harmonies. Well, the original production included a role for narrator, which we won't be hearing this evening. Instead, the piece starts with the first of 5 mansions or acts set in the Court of the Lilies. After the prelude, 2 Christian brothers, Marcus and Marcellianus, are bound to a pillar and about to be tortured, yet can still sing of Christ's love. Sebastian is awaiting his own punishment and asks God for a sign. An arrow he fires into the air miraculously doesn't return to earth, and the brothers are freed from their bonds. Sebastian performs a second miracle, dancing on hot coals which turn to lilies, and the brothers sing a hymn of praise. In the second mansion, the magic chamber, introduced by a dark and brooding solo on the contrabassoon, Sebastian heals the virgin Erigone, and she becomes a Christian. In the third, the Council of False Gods, Sebastian is put on trial in front of the Emperor Diocletian. The parallels with Christ that are so apparent in painters' portrayals of the saint are very much in evidence here. And then Diocletian is so swayed by Sebastian's words, he offers to make him a god, so rather missing the point. Sebastian angrily rejects the idea, and the result, he's condemned to death. A chorus of women, that applause you've just heard, greeting the arrival of the women on stage, weep for the death of the young Adonis. Sebastian himself bewails his suffering as the world is red with his torture. And then the 4th and 5th mansions run without a break. As a chorus of Syrians mourn, Sebastian is granted a vision of paradise. A chorus of apostles invites him to become one of their number. Angels urge him to scale the heights of music, and the soul of Saint Sebastian ascends to heaven. The culmination of the work is a chorus of all the saints praising the Lord with dulcimer and organ, timbrels and cymbals, flute and zither. Alleluia. While massed forces are required to render Debussy's music, the New London Chamber Choir have teamed up with the BBC National Chorus of Wales, and we're about to be joined by soloists Claire Booth, Polly May, and Claire McCaldon. They're joining the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Polly May and Claire McCaldon, both making their proms debuts this evening. They'll be standing in the centre of the chorus on the top risers above the orchestra, the two of them directly below the bust of Sir Henry Wood. And here comes Claire Booth, who'll be standing at the front, just to the left of the conductor. And that conductor, Oliver Nussum, following her to the front of the platform and applauding on his hand with his baton as she takes her bow. So this is The Martyrdom of Saint Sebastian by Claude Debussy.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh!
A chorus of all the saints praising the Lord with every instrument they can think of at the end of The Martyrdom of St. Sebastian by Debussy, who called on most of those instruments and more for that massive work. Music composed to accompany a stage performance conceived by the Italian poet and writer Gabriele D'Annunzio. Oliver Nusson giving the music its first complete airing at the Proms, conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra, the New London Chamber Choir, the BBC National Chorus of Wales, and soloists soprano Claire Booth and mezzos Holly May and Claire McAlden. Ollie Nusson kissing Claire Booth's hand, Claire Booth having to stand up on tiptoe. She's tiny compared with Oliver Nusson. Incidentally, the painting of the Martyrdom of St. Sebastian by the Polo Aiolo brothers that I was discussing earlier with Caroline Campbell at the National Gallery is available for you to see on the Radio 3 website, together with a longer version of our conversation. That's at bbc.co.uk/Radio 3. And here comes Claire Booth back onto the platform, followed by the chorus master, Adrian Partington, who's picking out the semi-chorus, Les Coryphées, drawn from the BBC National Chorus of Wales, which has a policy of using young singers, these eight singers just 19 or 20 years old, Vanessa Bowers, Amy Campbell, Sarah Chu, Francis Gregory, Lucy Hughes, Sean Newman, Philippa Scammell, and Eleanor Stowe. And Adrian Partington now bringing all the singers to their feet, and Ollie Nusson joining in by bringing the members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra into a standing position. The leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra tonight, Anna Coleman. Well, the Proms this year marking Debussy's 150th anniversary as well as Nusson's 60th birthday. And they'll be having a total immersion in Oliver Nusson's music in November. That's the Symphony Orchestra. Listen out for more details of that. There'll be more Debussy at the Proms, his ballet Je, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Simon Rattle, in the first of their two concerts on Thursday, the 30th of August. And the Symphony Orchestra will be back for their 10th Prom on Wednesday evening, the 29th. Martin Brabins with Elgar's First Symphony, and joined by the London Philharmonic Choir and the BBC Symphony Chorus for Howell's Hymnus Paradisi. But after our own vision of paradise this evening, that's it from the Royal Albert Hall. I'll hand you back to Jonathan Swain.
Louise, thank you very much. Louise Fryer there at the Royal Albert Hall, and as well as the iPlayer for listening online over the next 7 days, there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom broadcast here on BBC Radio 3, home of the Proms, on Thursday the 6th of September at 2 in the afternoon. And if that St. Sebastian music has you wanting more Debussy from the Proms, there's his Sonata for Flute, Viola and Harp in Monday's lunchtime chamber prom. That's at 1 o'clock on Monday. And as Louise was just saying, this Thursday evening, Debussy's Ballet Je is one of the pieces in the first of two proms this year with Sir Simon Rattle and his Berlin Philharmonic. Debussy and Je, very concerned about the sound of his score. In a letter to his friend André Caplet, he said, "I have to find an orchestration without feet for this music. I'm thinking of that orchestral colouring which seems lit from behind, and of which there are so many marvellous effects in Wagner's Parsifal." And you can hear Parsifal's Act 3 Prelude and the luminous Good Friday music in tomorrow night's prom. Daniele Gatti conducts the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra, and violinist Frank-Peter Zimmermann joins them for the Berg Violin Concerto. That's here on Radio 3 at 7:30 tomorrow night. Well, if you came to tonight's prom before the Debussy, you would have heard Night Songs by Helen Grime, twice in fact, once with Oliver Nusson's glasses on, once without. And Helen Grime was also the focus of a Proms composer portrait earlier this evening, for which she was joined by presenter Tom Service.
Well, Welcome to the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music in London, just over the road from the Royal Albert Hall, for this Proms composer portrait of the music of Helen Grime. Now, we're going to hear three chamber pieces by Helen, all of them played by students here at the Royal College of Music. Shadow Play for soprano, saxophone and piano, To See the Summer Sky for violin and viola, and we start, though, with 10 miniatures for solo piano. Now, look, Helen, I'm delighted you're on stage with me here. Look, you composed this piece when you were only in your late 20s. I mean, in your late 20s. I say that given that you were only 30 last year. I mean, all the music we're going to be hearing this evening is pretty recent. But look, 10 miniatures, but it's a single movement that plays for about 5.5 minutes. How did you compress all these 10 ideas, 10 little pieces, in a way, into one single movement?
Well, I wanted to write a piece where I was able to concentrate on tiny little miniatures, but I'm always thinking about the larger form. So there's a central idea, which is really quite simple, that you hear at the beginning. And my idea was that I wanted to see how I might take quite a simple idea and turn that material into quite unusual things. So often it might become something very different to the original idea. So really I wanted to set myself miniature challenges. So I'm doing very different things in these 10 movements, but also thinking about how I can create a piece which works as one movement.
And there's a big kind of expressive range you're using here, even in 5 minutes, the way that something melancholic, as you call it, goes into something exuberant. I mean, there's a big expressive range that connects these little miniatures as well.
Exactly, yeah. So I was thinking about contrasts, different speeds, very different atmospheres, but the musical material I'm using is not, that there's not very much of it actually. It's just that I'm trying to push it as far as I possibly can. It's a bit like a sort of a compositional study for me, really.
Perfect. Look, it's a perfect place to start this selection of three of your pieces. So please welcome on stage here at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall, Mayuko Yamashita, to play 10 miniatures for solo piano by Helen Grime. Mayuka Yamashita played Helen Grimes' 10 miniatures for solo piano. Now, look, Helen, something about that piece that makes it quite individual in the context of your whole output and the other pieces we're going to hear tonight, which have, the other two pieces have got titles, To See the Summer Sky and Shadow Play. I mean, most of your pieces have some kind of a character or descriptive title. So 10 miniatures doesn't, and other pieces rarely do in Europe. Why is that? Is there always a kind of extra musical or inspiration or something you're going for before, that's the impulse before you start a piece?
There often is an extra musical starting point. And actually, with the 10 miniatures, there was as well. It's just that I decided not to give it a descriptive title. Sometimes I like to keep the starting point as something which is just for me, and the piece moves away from it.
But it suggests that quite a lot of, I mean, what you're doing in that first bit of composition or the first bit of inspiration is about an idea that comes from something else, whether it's a thunderstorm, I don't know, a picture, a piece of literature, that you then want to translate into music somehow. Is it a translation of an idea or is it something more complicated?
Yeah, it's more that sometimes something from a line or a word in a poem or something about a picture that I'm looking at will focus my ideas in a certain way. And I'm just looking for that one sort of bit of excitement, that one sort of thing to get me going, really. And then I can move away from that. But I find that also it helps me to think of new ways of expressing things by looking at other art forms particularly.
What kind of thing are you thinking of? I mean, specific examples and pieces you've written. I mean, there's a wonderful, fantastic orchestral piece called Virga, which is one. I mean, it's such a fantastic idea. It's based on this meteorological thing, which is rain that evaporates before it gets to the ground, which creates this wonderful effect of light, which is a kind of epiphany that inspired the piece. I mean, other examples of that kind of thing?
So, I mean, it's sort of for that in that instance, it was translated into a sort of musical gesture. The idea of having extremes of register, for example, or falling gestures in the music. So it can be something like that. It might be a rhythmic idea, for example. One of the movements in the piano piece, actually, which is very still, but it's the two hands are quite separate and they're sort of marking out different tempos. And, you know, it's certain ideas like that which can suggest musical things to me, I find very useful. It helps me to try and say new things. I mean, obviously there's a language there and I want to be consistent, but I also want to try and do something different in each piece.
Do you remember a time when you weren't thinking compositionally? I mean, you are a very good oboe player. You played the oboe in the National Youth Orchestra of Scotland. I mean, has music always been that sort of thing for you? Or do you remember a time when you didn't have that kind of compositional impulse?
I'm not sure. Yes, I think when I was much younger, when I was a small child, I was very interested in drawing, and that was really the thing that I would do all the time. But it always went along with music. I listened to a lot of music that came through the family. My grandparents were both music teachers. My mother's a music teacher as well. So, there was always a lot of music in the house. And, of course, I played piano and then later recorder and oboe. So it was just something that felt quite natural. And I was very, very lucky to go to a music school in Edinburgh where all students were offered composition lessons. And it was something that, you know, it was felt that everyone should try doing.
What was that like, that first experience of composing? I mean, was it difficult, or was it that moment, a kind of Damascene moment where you think, this is what I should do?
I think it's not difficult when you first sort of start composing. If only it was so easy now, but something that felt very personal and special. And of course what I was doing wasn't particularly personal or original. It would be very unusual if it was at that young stage, but it felt like something precious to me.
That's a very precious thing, isn't it? I mean, that feeling that what you're doing, because I mean, presumably if it didn't feel that it was something that you had to do for yourself,
you wouldn't devote
a life to it, no. So looking back on that period now, were you influenced, though, by other composers, things that inspired you, that kicked you off?
Well, if I look back at, I actually found some early compositions quite recently, And it's very, they're very much influenced by French music, and particularly Debussy. I can really see that in the piano writing. And I listened to a lot of Debussy and Ravel when I was younger, and they were still composers who are hugely important for me.
What about living composers? Were there, do you remember an encounter with a, you know, with a living composer that made you think, okay, composers aren't just people who write the music who aren't alive anymore, but are people around
yeah.
us?
I mean, things, I went to a prom when I was a lot younger, and Tippett was there, and that was exciting. It's always amazing to see the person who's created this thing, and not just to think of something that, you know, the composers are all dead. So it's, yeah.
Were you attracted to, you know, the avant-garde music when you were growing up?
Yes, I was. I mean, I just listened to a lot of music, and I think that expanded certainly when I came to college as well, and I started listening to much, much more. And around about that time, I heard Nussen's music, so some late teenage years, and I was immediately struck by this incredibly beautiful, precise sound world. And it just seemed to me when I heard his music for the first time that I couldn't, it just, all the notes were the right notes, and you couldn't have changed any of them. It's so, so beautiful and perfect.
Wonderful then that he's conducting, of course, the world premiere of Night Songs, your orchestral piece. Look, To See the Summer Sky, what's the story behind the right notes? I've heard it in rehearsal, I promise these are the right notes, into To See the Summer Sky. What's the inspiration for this piece?
Well, actually, you know, speaking of having an extra musical stimulus, this has a poetic title, and it's from Emily Dickinson, but the title actually came after the piece, so it wasn't the starting point. Sometimes the instruments themselves are just enough, and in this case, the violin and the viola, it's such a wonderful combination. You can make so many different sounds on string instruments, and yeah, that was really, I just went wild with it, I think, with this piece. It's a lot of fun.
Four movements, again, very sharply contrasted. Do you, as you'll hear, the fourth movement is this fantastic motu perpetuo mm-hmm. That has all kinds of surprises in it, especially after the three movements we've heard before then. I mean, do you know when you start a piece like this, about 12, 13 minutes long, where you're going to end up when you start writing?
Well, I did in the case of this piece. This piece was interesting because the last movement I wrote first, and I actually wrote it when I was studying in Tanglewood. In America.
In Boston, near Boston.
Yeah, so the funny thing about this was one of the exercises we had to do when we were away was write a piece a day. So that last movement I wrote in a day.
You wrote that whole last movement in one day?
Yeah, I mean, it's very short. It's probably like 45 seconds, but it's very fast. There's a lot of notes in it, yeah. but then that was a good starting point then for the rest of the piece, and often starting from a different point, whether it be the end or from somewhere in the middle, can help them with generating the rest of the piece, I think.
Well, let's hear it now. So please welcome on stage here at the Royal College of Music to play Helen Grimes' To See the Summer Sky, violinist Joseph Duval and viola player Natasha Silva.